we'd like to start with is if you could just tell a little bit about yourself, you know, where you grew up, and how you got started on the waterfront. Then we'll go into asking difficult questions that we want you to answer.
Well, I grew up about 30 miles from here in a town named Inumka. I moved out there when I was a year old, Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I worked in the sawmill, and I worked in the construction business. My brother got an opportunity to get me on the waterfront. That's how I came on the waterfront.
So he went first to the waterfront. He started working.
My older brother had to name.
What year was that that you first started?
I started in 1948.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
A lot of people worked in the shipyard, yes.
Over the place.
Right. So, you started out as an extra?
As an extra,
for how long before you?
I was for 2 years, I think. 1950, uh-huh. I think.
Why did it take so long? Was there just not enough work to pull people into the union fast enough? Or?
I think in 1946, they had took 50, I believe, and they just hadn't taken any, and about 19, it must have been 1950, they decided they were going to take 50 more, and I happened to be one of them, one of the lucky ones, I guess you would put it.
In those days, did they still have the sponsor system?
Yes, we had to get 10 signatures. Which was hard to do if you didn't have much ambition, but if you had any ambition, it was very easy to do because everybody was looking for workers in them days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't make any difference. You was cousin, nephew, brother, or nothing. You had to produce.
Mm-hmm.
And if you was a good worker, well, you had no trouble getting any signature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She wasn't.
By the early 50s, was there quite a bit of work? It seems like the Korean War maybe would have generated.
No, not too much.
No,
it was a hit and miss property. In fact, when I was trying to get in, I think I went 6 months without one day, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Very fortunate. My wife had a little job that put food on the table. But we had a little savings that I had saved when I was in Alaska. And blew all that.
Yeah, it's easy to do.
Yeah.
So when did the work start to pick up? I know in the 50s it was up and down.
Yes, yeah, it didn't pick up until about 19. Well, about 60 it started. Then 61 it came a little more, and I think maybe in 62 we started to load logs. Right? No, I guess it was 61 we started to load logs, and that's when it actually started. Mm-hmm. Pick it up then.
So during the 50s, logs was not one of the cargoes.
No, Sperry's kept us mostly going on the smelter.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we did load lumber them days. So mm-hmm. We used to have them little poles and boats that run in here, and they'd dump the salt off, and then they'd take a load of lumber back. So mm-hmm. that was always good.
Mm-hmm.
We had quite a few war boats.
I always think of the 50s as being a time of real low unemployment and very, you know, affluent. And why were longshoremen not sort of getting any of those advantages? Do you have any idea sort of why the work was not steady during that period? Or?
Yeah, I guess it was just, well, we didn't really have, one thing, we didn't have no facility. All we had was Pier 2, that's in Pier 1. There was no equipment there whatsoever. They had a couple of cranes that they could lift about 3 or 4 ton. That's all, just to run on the side of the building at Pier 2. Absolutely useless, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe put a lift jitney in the hold or something. And the ships were, you know, they were all built them days with 3 or 4 tween decks and
mm-hmm.
just weren't made for the way they are now to run the
land. So it's sort of poor port facilities. I mean, there just
absolutely
wasn't anything to attract ships.
And poor management.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Absolutely poor. They didn't care whether they got anything. Longshoremen to the port was a bad word, you know. They hated us.
Mm-hmm.
Just hated us.
Wasn't it during that period that they were spending most of their energy on this industrial development stuff, or?
I don't know. I don't think they were spending any energy anyway. That's the truth.
I get the impression from the newspaper clippings they were mostly concerned about, you know, buying up lands in the back.
Well, they might have bought a lot of land in those days, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they just naturally fell into the land, you know. They might have. I'm not going to say for sure whether they bought all.
But your general impression was that as far as the longshoremen were concerned, they really didn't give a hoot.
We wasn't allowed to talk to them, you know, none of the officials. I was like cat and dog, you know, they were just. Of course, I hate to say this, but in them days, our officials, to talk to an employer, that was a sin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they figured that that's my enemy, and if you think they'd sit down and have coffee together, not a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Not a chance, because you was fraternizing or whatever you call it.
Fraternizing with the enemy?
Yeah, with the employer, and that was a forbidden sin.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first start getting involved in the local's politics and getting...
I got involved, I think it was the second year I belonged. Mm-hmm. I got elected to the executive board. That's where I started. And of course, I always was a loud mouth anyway. As I had a union meeting, I don't say too much on the job unless something's wrong. But I had a union meeting, I believe, in the voice of my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get on the water front, you know, you had to keep your mouth shut. That's what my brother told me when it started. If somebody says it's dark outside, you say it sure is, you know. And you agree. So I made up my mind. And I can tough her out till I get there. Once I get there, then I'm going to have my say. And I've had my say for 31 years. I'm sure I didn't do too much harm to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you were business agent in 62 and through 64.
4 years, I've been in.
Uh-huh. And then you were president, what have I got, 68 to 71?
I think I put 4 years there, too.
Uh-huh. Now, going back to the 50s, towards the end of the 50s, before they came up with the M&M agreement, the PMA went through a period. Lee Reichel was talking about it the other day when he was in these conformance and performance programs.
Yeah.
What were your... I got the impression from Lee that, one, they weren't working, and two, they... Basically, all they were doing was getting so nitpicky about every little tiny thing that it was just like harassment all the time.
Well, I think that was the days of the mechanization. First, that's when they really harassed us. But they harassed us as soon as we got in the ILWU, you know. They couldn't harass us before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause we was over here sitting by ourselves, pretty independent. If something wasn't right, we just quit work. And we didn't go back to work until we got it straightened out.
And you were dealing directly with only the employers involved here in Tacoma.
Just us. We was the power here. As soon as we got in the ILWU, I'm not saying it was a mistake, I say it was a good move. But then the employers, you know, if you did something wrong, then you had to go through all the channel and stop work. That was only way you could stop was for safety, so you couldn't stop for just a beef.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to do it right, and we got in lots of trouble. Not so much in the 50s, but I remember when I was business agent, boy, it was a bad habit of the guys. We quit, and I never could stop them with that, and I tried, but, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I used to make excuses.
You got to defend them even though you're not sure if what they did was right.
The record, the longshoreman is wrong 8 times out of 10. That's true. But the business agent, you have to stick up for them. That's your job. You know, the other guys will pay you. So you make an effort. But they're smart on the other side. You know, they got lawyers, they got this. Who are we? Just work. Sometimes you out-scream them. You know, they get tired of listening to you. They kind of give you your way a little bit. You know?
Uh-huh.
But basically, if they think you're trying to do the right thing, they're real good, honestly. I tell you, I can't see how we got that a bunch of employers like we really have. I mean, especially in my day, we had this fella called Tiny Tronson. You know him, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
He was the greatest. He'd try anything, you know, if he thought he'd get away with it. But if you caught him, he didn't go wincing around. He knew he was caught. See? But he'd try, and he'd never give up.
Was he one of the harder employers to deal with? I get a lot of people sort of talking about Rothschild as having had a history of being, you know, one of the more demanding and tougher employers.
It's a tradition, I really think, because Rothschild had all the work, you know, here. That's all there was Rothschild and maybe a couple of subsidiaries of Rothschild. Saddle Steve was unheard of here, you know. So it was always Rothschild, and they had some hard-headed bosses. Man, they had the hard-headedest bosses you ever seen in your life, and you did it their way or else, a couple of them. But that all changed, too. Them bosses are retired. You know, Tiny was smart. He was smart because he was coming right out of that local, you know.
Right, sure. See?
So he, you couldn't, some of them guys you could fool, they didn't know the contract too good, see. You can't fool Tiny, you know, from one to the A to Z.
When did the first real serious discussion of going into the ILWU start? The vote was taken in December 57. How long had it been sort of really seriously under discussion?
I think we're in about 2 years, but 55, I think. I think when it really started, and I tell you how much power the ILWU really has. They had the employers on their side too. Although somebody might tell you they didn't, but I know they did.
Well, it would be the employer's advantage to have everyone under the same
Absolutely.
Contract.
See, they tried, one time they come over and they made a deal with us. They said, we couldn't travel, you know. Well, we're going to travel now. We can have inner travel.
Something like that.
I don't know. But anyway, no strings attached. So this goes for about a month. The first day it went into effect, I think we had something like, we had 29 gangs here, I think. Then I think we had 23 of them in Seattle. They had them scattered. One on the ship didn't need us. Didn't need us at all, but they had us there one day. So the guys all got, there wasn't much work here, you know, terrible. They were keeping the ships out, really. Once in a while we get a lining ship, that's about all we get. So this goes on for about a month, and all at once they said, no more, not unless you join the ILWU. You see how smart they was? They got all the guys all hopped up, and that swung a lot of votes, really. Because that was the battle cry, well, we get to travel.
How long did this traveling arrangement go on before they sort of said, you know, gave you this kind of ultimatum?
About 2 months, maybe three. I'm sure it wasn't any longer.
Oh, so the traveling really didn't last very long.
Oh, terrible. No, just enough to get them, you know, and they said no more until you join the ILWU. That gave them a little more iron to holler about up here. I think it ended up, there was 91 of us left on the other side. The rest were all for the ILWU.
So you voted against going in?
Yes, I did.
What were your reasons?
The reason was I didn't believe in their policy. I thought they were out and out commies, I'm sure they've changed now. But Harry Bridges, there's no doubt in my mind that Harry was a commie at one time. Then Goldblatt. Who else did he have? He had Goldblatt and Bridges, a guy by the name of Thomas, I think, were the heads. Goldblatt, he's still a commie. You know, a smart man, you know. You don't have to talk to him over 5 minutes to find out which way he said. The Harry, I think, him and Goldblatt are dead mortal enemies right now. He used to be just like this. And I think, I'm sure Harry seen light and went the other way. To me, he's a great guy, a great guy. One of the better men I have, but, you know, as far as the workers, he's a great guy. That was my reason. Because I didn't...
How did you, the people on your side who were supporting staying in the ILA, how did you approach the problem with the pensions?
Well, it was seemed to be stable, but they kept us misinformed, too. The guy that was supposed to be taking care of that was our Secretary of Treasury. And then just the secretary, not the treasurer, just the secretary. And he was an ILWU man. So when their pension come up, they were supposed to do something to the pension. Very conveniently, he missed the meeting or something, and something happened, and the pension system was going to, the ones that were on pension was going to have to take a cut or something. Mm-hmm. Right? So. That's another thing.
He missed a union meeting or a meeting with
employers? No, the meeting, he was on the Board of Trustees.
Oh, the pension plan.
He missed that by saying that he was misinformed or some feeble excuse. You know, I knew it was a feeble excuse, but...
Who was that?
Lyman Connell. He's dead, though. He was strictly an ILWU man.
Had he always been? Or had he been here in the late 30s?
He was here before me, but he was a funny guy. He was useless as far as I'm concerned. As far as a worker, he was terrible. He never did know that. The best job he ever had would have put him secretary. He was a good secretary, but I got my reservations about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew the bookwork. That's what he was cut out to do, not the longshore. I don't know how he ever made it in the first place, but he was here before me, so I didn't have nothing to do with that. But he was a nice guy to talk to, don't get me wrong. You know, he had a nice family, a wife, and two boys, I think. A nice enough guy. He wasn't cut out to be a worker. He was an office worker, is what he was. And he was a good secretary, but I think he got...
So you think, in some sense, on the pension thing, that people were sort of scared into going into the IWU because they were sort of given the wrong information about what would happen with their pensions?
Yeah. And probably even... saying it was, I know it was the wrong information, but I think the pension system would have went broke. There's no question in my mind it would have went broke, you know, because as things go, something's got to happen, and I'm sure we couldn't support it, tonnage or hour-wise or anything else. And, well, you know, that's a big item, the pension and welfare, big item.
Sure.
So, overall, but it was a good fight. Man, we had fun. Every union meeting just...
Was it a friendly fight?
Yeah, very friendly. Then guys, and they used to get on me, you know, and I'd get on them. And in fact, I worked right in the same gang with the Winchdriver and Hatchton, who were both ILWU men. Lee Reichel was one of my better friends. He's a strong... He never made no bones, and I didn't make no bones. We a friend. Argue like hell, but... You know, he'd never come and try to change me, or I wouldn't change him, because he knew it was no use, and I knew the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. Good friend.
Was it mostly the older men who swung the vote, or...?
No, I think it was... most of the older men were for... we had a few on our... But they had most of them, yeah.
Because of the pension thing, you think they were worried about?
Yeah, they were looking out for that. They thought it was better than they... And the younger guys wanted to travel, and, you know, they, so it was, it wasn't close, the vote wasn't close, you know, and you end up with only 90 on one side, I'm sure we had about...
Do you remember what the vote was? Because
no,
the newspaper
really.
Clipping, they didn't announce it, and Lee couldn't remember what
it
was.
It wasn't close, though. Just, they swamped. No, they swamped us.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a big celebration that night. In fact, they invited me to come down to the Carlton Hotel down the bar. I said, no thanks, you guys. I put strychnine in the drinks. I told that to Johnny Slavik and Fred Sellers.
Did any people quit because they got into the ILWU? I mean,
no,
or did people just accept the fact they'd lost and just...
No, we had one guy that, a couple of them made a vow they'd never travel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by God, I think he traveled once in all the years. And when the guy by the name of Leo Marshall, he was a stubborn Missourian when he made up his mind. Like, I don't even know if he traveled. I think he got on the payroll. That was it. And we kidded. They was going to send the gang, and they called up and said they didn't need the gang. Just put the guys on the payroll, and he was one that got on the payroll. So, oh man, we razzed him to death about thought you wasn't going to travel and all that. But he never did. Never did go out of town. Uh-huh. And he survived. I guess he didn't need to travel to make a living.
Why didn't the move into the IOW happen sooner than it did? Like, why in 53 when you got traveling and they sort of said, all right, we're going to stop the traveling unless you join, why didn't people say, all right, well, let's, you know, join then?
I think because everybody was making a living. I wouldn't say it was a good living, but... longshoremen in them days, you know, about 2 or 3 days a week, and then you go fishing. That was their lifestyle, you know. I remember we used to get out of jobs, and we used to say, hurry up, let's get off here. I want to go fishing, you know. And if you had 3 days in, and that was good enough.
You could get by on that.
And I used to try to make $100 a week. That's what I pattered myself for. And if I made 100, I don't worry anymore that week. Mm-hmm. Wait till next week. Mm-hmm. But I didn't lay back for anything easy or anything like that. You know, I took a job. When I went there to get a job, I took a job. I did.
What then, in 58, what was the, or 57 then, what was the difference? Was there even less work by then, or was
yes,
it?
Yes, terrible.
It was terrible then, huh?
Yeah, terrible. Yeah, it was, like I say, I think the employers were putting the squeeze on the stew. I'm sure they kept
diverting
a lot of
ships. Yeah,
they just weren't coming. Well, we never had any in the first place. We had never had no regular, outside of Matson. We had the Matson there. That was, you know, I think they come once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they kept on coming. But they put a line and ship in every now and then. They wouldn't let us starve, but they were just showing us, you know, that they didn't have to come here. I'm sure of that. I'm sure they were in hand trying to get us in the island. And you can't blame them for that. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to deal that way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Was the port itself, you think, taking sides at all?
Yeah, they didn't take care of less. Mm-hmm. Take care of less. They didn't want any business down there. You could go down there. It was actually a disgrace to go down to the warehouse, Pier 2. They had a box of tire ropes on one end and a bunch of old car axles on the other. That's what they had there. It's a fact. You could throw a rock, you could never hit nobody or nothing. Absolutely terrible. They had them old fuddy-duddies that been there for years, good, and a few more of them, been there for years. Cared less.
Mm-hmm.
They cared less.
What changed that? Because the port now, I mean, yeah. Obviously, it's not been sitting still.
I'll tell you what changed it is the longshoremen, for one, help, you know, mm-hmm. by being kind of aggressive and not so stuck up, I would say. They started in, I think, Boyd Smith became business agent 1 year. He was quite well-liked. He was foreman now. He dresses nice. He's got a memory like an elephant. Remember everything. And he gets along with people. And they all liked it. Port liked it, the employer liked him. And I forget what year, that was in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Then after him it was Tony Tomatins. Tony's same type, you know, he got along with good guy. I think I was on labor relations in them days. In fact, I know I was because I used to go with Boyd places and Tony. And then Tony didn't want to run anymore, so he asked me if I would run, so I said, well, maybe for a year or so then.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the port had, he's retired now, he was acting, when I was business, he'd act in the, what's the guy's name? Jesus, I can't think of it. But he was the acting manager.
I'm sure I have that somewhere.
Yeah,
I can't even remember now.
Mark somebody, I think his name is Mark. I'm sure it's Mark.
I know, I can find it. I know I've got it in my notes somewhere.
But he's retired now. He worked there for years.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was acting manager until Perry was brought
in?
Yeah.
They were looking for one. See, that's
right.
When they had to see who were the commissioners. There's one thing I should tell you, too. When they elected these port commissioners, I think it was Stan Erdahl and Maurice Raymond and Archie Blair. They were commissioners, and I'll tell you, they were the three best guys in the world. They wanted to see something done, and they wanted to know everything that went on, too.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have the meetings every Wednesday, and I used to sit in on the meetings. And I tell you, they used to get up. Oh, no, I should take that back. It wasn't Mark neither. It was a guy by the name of Gene Seaton. He was the port man. He hated our guts. He was at Schaefer Dock, you know. And he come from Schaefer Dock. He couldn't do much to us at Schaefer because we had the upper hand. If he wanted to monkey with the longshoremen, heard about fair play.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you one little incident about what kind of guy he was. One time we was there loading the barge, and they had the World Series was on, and they had their office right there, and they had the radio on so we could hear the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
So he's seen us doing this, so he goes and shut the thing off. Yeah. So he, just to agitize us, that's what. And then he got to be the manager here at the port. And he was he's a liar, a little weaselly bugger, and he do it. But I used to squeal on him every chance he got. And one time, I tell you, he did this to Tony. He said, we had our doghouse down there. It was a pretty nice building, and had a oil stove in there, and it was leaking, it stunk, and fumes all over. So Tony went down and said to him, how about our lunchroom down there? Good enough, he said. I ain't fixing no lunchroom. He said he had fixed up his office with big plush rug and all that crap,
Mm-hmm.
So Tony didn't argue with him, so Tony and I go down there. We see Archie Blair and Maury Raymond. We said, come on over, we'll show you something. We took them over to the doghouse and showed them that doghouse. So they're having that afternoon. Tony and I are sitting there, and you should have heard what the commissioner stole that Mr. Seaton. Oh, boy, he felt like going under the table. Next day, they got all the carpenters the port owned over there fixing our doghouse for us.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he got a little trouble down there, and he got fired. That's when Mark was acting manager, right after that, while they were looking for a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they found Perry. And the first time I seen this guy, he was going down through the warehouse, down between the piles, and I thought to myself, Jesus, holy Christ, what did they do to us now? And they got to meet the guy. Now, the first thing you do, you go in his office, and he says to his secretary, bring some coffee. Did you imagine that? Anybody bringing coffee for a longshoreman? For Christ's sake, never unheard of. Unheard of. Hey, well, he made a big hit right there when he brought me coffee, I guarantee you. And he was the greatest guy, I tell you. Just wanted to get something done. He's an engineer to start with, see. So he wants to build something. That's what he did.
I know, because I did an interview with him, and he said when he first came here, he didn't think the business agent and the port manager had talked to each other in years.
Talked to Mark, but not Seaton. Seaton and I didn't see eye to eye. He was too easily for me. I believe in being, I was honest with everybody. I never lied, I'd lie about a guy being drunk or something like that. But basically, I wouldn't lie. Like, if a guy got caught stealing, I'm not lying for it, no way. If I give my word, I never went back at my word. I didn't have to write it all out on a piece of paper for me. I just gave my word. Him and I just seemed to hit it off for some reason. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when she started to go with it. But longshoremen, we used to meet once a month with them. Him and the stevedore company, all the stevedore company. We had a meeting over the Port Industrial Dock. And we talk over the problems, what
mm-hmm.
we could do to improve. I guess we made her go. So the
so his basically, he had just had a whole different attitude.
Oh,
his
yeah.
sort of preventing grievances rather than waiting until they came up.
Absolutely. And once in a while he'd put in the paper what a great job the longshoremen's doing, you know, not the hell of a, that's the only thing we ever seen in the paper. Some longshoreman got picked up for drunk or beating his wife or getting a divorce. That's the only time you ever seen a longshoreman. But once he got there, once in a while he'd put in there what a great job the longshoremen are doing. That does wonders, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you catch a lot of bees with honey, you don't catch any with vinegar.
Yeah. Well, let's go back when the M&M came in. Were you involved at all in the caucus meetings prior to the actual signing of the agreement? Were you a caucus delegate? Do you remember who the caucus delegates were?
I don't think I was in on that caucus delegate. No, I know I was. No, not on the M&M agreement. Did that come in? No, when did that come in?
61 was the first one.
No, I wasn't in. No, 62 was the first convention when I went to. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in.
Do you remember by chance who might have been the caucus delegates?
I'm sure Tony was on it, because he was a business agent. Tony Tomatich.
And that's sort of traditional that the business agent is also a delegate.
Most of the time. Well, it's not traditional, but most of the time they send the business agent along with the president automatically goes. And I can't remember who was president. It must have been. 60.
Oh,
60. I think it was
the negotiations started in 58 or 9. There were informal ones. And then they got serious. Let's see, Emory was president 58-59, Feely in 60, Williamson in 61.
Yeah, Walt was there on the M&M, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who was with him. I got no idea who would be our delegate then.
Well, the first time that the agreement was presented, how did the men react to it?
They didn't like it down here. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm sure we voted it out by a substantial margin, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If my memory serves me right.
Why? What were the main things they didn't like?
Well, they didn't want to lose all that manpower, you know. They wanted the gang structure the same, because this fort was built on the gang structure, you know. That's what they wanted.
Was work still slow in 61?
61, yeah.
There was reason to think they would lose work.
Yes, it was just starting in 61 to pick up a little, so we really thought we were going to have to have a word against it myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, once it came in, what difference did it make? Was there a difference right away? I mean, could you tell the difference between the old Manning rules and the new Manning rules right away?
There was restrictions, you know. We had a lot of bees. A lot of bees, especially on the sling loads, because they built bigger loads, you know. But they were entitled.
Safety was supposed to be the only factor.
Yeah, but also we was entitled if they built certain size load and built it here, then we was entitled to a couple more men. We had quite a problem with police than that, you know.
Because they were building the loads off the docks, or
no, they built some here.
They build them without putting on the extra.
Yeah, we was entitled to two extra men, I think, in the hole. We had to hustle quite a bit to make sure.
Do you think they were just being careless, or was it a concerted effort to sort of push the limits and see how far they could go?
The employers.
They
tried it, but
hi, Frank.
Where's you at this morning? Trying to miss you.
No, I didn't. I'm usually on Friday.
Too busy, huh?
Starts the whole work soon.
One day, I was going to learn how, you know. So I rode around with him for about half an hour. He's going wide open. He's got her in high gear going wide open. So he finally gets out of the seat and he said, "Okay, Carl, your turn. Put her down in low." He said, "Me, put her down low. It's okay for him to have her in high and me hanging on for dear life. But he ain't gonna hang on when I go on the high, because I don't blame him."
Didn't some reporter come out and ride the Strad with you? I guess they had just when they had first come in and he was doing some kind of article about all this fancy new equipment.
No, it wasn't a reporter.
Somebody, because I remember reading a thing in the TNT, in the clippings, in the scrapbook, about someone riding with you in a Strad carrier, and they were talking about how you know, how you would go over the railroad tracks, the whole thing would bounce like this, and they thought they were going to fall out.
No, it was the, I tried to get Don Mossman.
Uh-huh.
I told Don, I says, come on, go for a ride with me. I'll show you what kind of stuff we got to go through over on this dock. Well, he says, we'll have somebody. So, the heck was the name of the guy, his assistant?
Yeah, I can't think of his name.
I took him up, and I gave him the words.
McKenzie?
No, he wasn't there yet.
Oh.
I gave him the words. They had a place where you went out to the ship where there was a bump, just about so high, and you'd hit that thing and you'd go like this. That sheet of paper looks white compared to what he looked when I got through with him. It took him 15 minutes to get down off that machine. But I showed him just exactly what the heck we had to go through. Then the time I put the doggone Clark on three wheels, going around the corner, cutting into some vans. And at that time, this is one reason I told him, I said, now listen. I said, you've got crowns. And this dock, and I says, when you're up in the straddle carrier, you can't see those crowns where the water runs off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I says, why don't you paint some waggle lines along there so that we'll know when we're running this? I think it took them a year to do it, but they finally did put something up. But and then there was one place I had at number four, that Starcon. I had a 20-ton van. We just waited. And I went down there where they had I don't know whether it was a sewer manhole cover. It was raised a little.
Yeah.
And I had that van all probably a foot off in the ground. And I hit that thing and I went up on two wheels with that Starcon. That's the only time that I've ever been scared. I thought, sure, that thing was going over, even though I had all that weight down there. And I just told him, I says, gee whiz, you're going to get somebody killed here.
Yeah, the movement, when you're up at the top, the movement is very exaggerated from even the smallest little, something you wouldn't notice in a car, up in one of those things, you would notice much more.
The thing of it is, you see, you only have the four wheels, and if it ever got the bucking, then you had no control over it. It would just, you'd be surprised how much of a beating you took. You'd have to stop in order to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the major complaint that we had on the unevenness of the dock. And then the day I turned around and I made the remark over, it was on a Friday, I made the remark over it, 7B. I said, starting Monday morning, we're not driving the Starcons over there with any containers because the road is too rough. Somebody's going to get hurt. Going to tip one of these over. It's pretty hard to tip, though. They were pretty stable. First thing you know, I was up in the office over the port. I said, you guys won't listen. The only way we can shut her down for safety. My gosh, we didn't drive that Starcon over. We used the Germans to go over there.
Yeah, they're a little smoother.
Well, they had four wheels, on each side, and you were stable. But when you got in there with that Starcon and that ditch over there, somebody go into that. They did go in. A couple times they let the truck drivers run them off in the road. Truck driver never run me off in the road.
Mm-hmm.
I give him the business. So this is the thing that when we first started, the problems we had especially on Pier 4,
mm-hmm.
because of the roughness, and it wasn't designed for a container dock.
No, really.
Because it would you had too many places that went in for the water draining.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you had to start someplace, I guess. Now it don't make any difference. But that old Clark that we had, Many a mile I put on that.
See, we were talking about when the M&M first came in. And you were saying that there were a lot of problems. Interpretation and that kind of stuff.
We had problem with the coffee break. You know.
Oh, yeah, I think Lee had mentioned that. They wanted people to take them individually to rotate them.
Yeah, individually. We was used to taking coffee break when we wanted to, you know.
The whole gang at once.
But we never abused it either. We used to just sit down if they'd holler, what are you doing down there? We'd tell them we're papering off or something. That's the way we used to. No, there was no such thing as coffee break. Mm-hmm. Everybody used to take one, you know, on their own accord and the way they wanted it. It's always further back away so the boss never could see anybody out there, you know. We used to be back in the waiting or something. Mm-hmm. He'd holler down, what are you doing? We'd say, well, we're papering off, you know. Because you always had to put paper in the wings and all around the steel. Everything. That's what we was always doing. But as soon as they put it in the contract, then we got in nothing but trouble. Everybody wanted a unit break, and they said no unit break. So, we had more gangs fired, I tell you, just every day, seems like. In fact, I remember one time Rothschild fired. I was down in the hole, and I had seven young, I think most of them were sons with me, all on permit. And I was the only longshoreman. I had all these sons, and we're loading paper rolls, and I'm trying to keep them from getting killed, and trying to show them what to do. And we was papering off, and Sinclair and I can't remember who the Winchester was, they took the coffee break. Mm-hmm. And the next thing I knew, the guy said, come on up, you're fired. I happened to be on labor relations at that time, and I thought, well, it's this one time you're going to lose, you know. And I thought we had him. You can't lose down there. We're working. We're actually papering off, as it actually was. I don't think you can fire somebody unless you have the cause. That's the way it's always been explained to me, so I took it to labor relations, and they stalled, and it was against Rothschild and Tiny. They stalled. They knew they were beat, but they stalled. Well, I think it also was in that contract that if you did something wrong, your employers had a right to punish you through proper channels and all that. So they finally they knew they were beat. Only thing it was going to cost them was 8 hours for me and 4 hours for the kid. That's all they were entitled to. And it was before, it was right after 10 o'clock. And they said, okay, we'll pay you, Carl, but we got to do something to Sinclair. Well, I'm not going to sacrifice one of my brothers for 4 hours or 8 hours pay. I got paid two as it was. That'd be 6 hours more. I said, well, you guys are pretty foxy. I said, no thanks. I said, we'll just drop it. So we dropped that case. But that went on time and time again. The gang would get fired.
Did it finally end up in the coast? Committee, or?
Yeah, they had them, they'd write back. We got reams and reams of paper every day telling us the rules, and even the Coast Committee couldn't agree amongst themselves what the hell the rules was, you know. Mm-hmm. First they'd tell you one thing, and then they'd tell you another thing, and it was nothing but problem. We just had rules of the problem. Especially with the coffee. And that was the main. And they finally got it settled down and everybody took a coffee break.
Now what about Slingwell? How much advantage did the employers try to take of that?
Not too much, maybe. Maybe they put, well, at first we only had, I would say, not too popular around here. It didn't have much of a word. It didn't have much effect on us to sing. We had some folk there. And it just made bales bigger.
By 66, by the second M&M agreement, had those kinds of problems basically been worked out?
Yeah, just
did things calmed down by then?
Yeah, I think everything would run pretty smooth then, Because Tony got most of them worked out in his, Tony got the brunt of it. He was a business agent when it first came in, so I think he only stayed 1 year, but he got most of the problems worked out when I took over then. Basically, it was running pretty smooth. It's run pretty smooth ever since, I would say. George might tell you different, but I don't think so. I think it's...
And what about, excuse me.
Go ahead.
What about the 71 strike? Now that, it's my impression that the real issue, and the real sticky issue, was the whole question of steady man.
Well, not here so much. Our guys wouldn't. I'm sure that's why we went on strike, you know, steady men and all that, but here we never had no problem with steady men. We never had any outside of a few crane drivers. But then I think, I don't even think we had any steady men outside of the gear guys in 71.
Now, after that was settled and the employers got the right to employ steady men, was there, did they try to do much of that here?
Right here?
Did you manage to keep the rotation?
No, they didn't. You see, it was up to the individual. If the employer could ask for steady men, but people had a right to refuse. And all our guys, that's the way it was. They just, nobody was going to go steady. That was it. So they just, no problem. No problem with steady men, which was a big problem on the coast.
Now, I know, particularly, I guess, in Seattle, they had all kinds of job actions and everything because the employer just kept pushing and pushing.
Yeah, they had lots of trouble in Seattle. But here, there was no problem with steady men. Now they got steady men. I don't think it's good for the union, but they're here, and I guess there's not anything to do about them. Some of my best friends are working steady down the elevator down there. Well, I always thought we were a pretty tough union. Don't you go steady?
Well, it changes your relationship with them. I mean, it's your employer then rather than the union, which is your main.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody can tell you any different. It doesn't change your attitude. There would be certain things you would do that you wouldn't do otherwise. You know? Not like working overtime or anything like that, you know, but just little things, you know, little things. You see some little thing that's wrong, you're not going to say nothing, you know. Or if you're just working, why, you grumble a little bit. They'd hear about it eventually. They don't know how steady it is. Yeah.
Well, in the 71 strike, since the issue of steady men then was not really a hot one for Tacoma, did the guys really want to go out?
They seemed to. We had quite a few young guys and they had never been on strike.
They wanted their chance?
They were gung ho. It was actually, I think everybody had really enjoyed herself.
Well, of course, nobody ever tried to run strike breakers, so you didn't really.
No, we had to. First couple of days, we put picket lines out, you know. And after, but we had made a deal with the port dock, you know, that they could work. So there was trucks going in and out, and we felt like idiots down there standing picket line, you know. And so we decided, no more picket line. And we had our regular crews, and we kept them at, I think it was four on at a time. Four or eight, I can't remember now, Four for the hall and four for picket duty, so that was eight. So we kept them right at the union hall. They were there night and day. We had a ball. We had the ice box. Four would sandwich meat and Yeah, we made better sandwiches there than we ever did at home. I guarantee you that. Yeah.
Well, now Lee was saying that he didn't think much of the 71 strike because it seemed like there were so many exceptions being made for certain kinds of work and stuff.
It really wasn't.
It really wasn't a shutdown.
No, we worked. I think we averaged 2 and 3 days a week.
Even during the strike.
Yeah, we worked for the port and then we worked for the American Mail Army cargoes.
Military cargoes.
Yeah, military, mm-hmm. Yeah. We worked, and they were coming maybe twice a month, you know.
Uh-huh. Now, why was there an agreement to let the port work?
Well, because we didn't want to shut them down on account of the rubber and all that. See, they had lots of rubber
stored.
Sort of
perishable classification.
Yeah, stuff like that, you know.
So they were only running perishables then,
or they would go ahead and just run? Yeah, we loaded rubber and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we ordered, went by alphabet. That's how we took the job. So many a day, whatever they'd order, they'd go on the alphabet. If he wasn't there, you missed your turn. Right, the next guy.
Mm-hmm.
We kept the clerks, we only give them... We didn't give them all the clerk's job, but it was seemed to be quite a few supervisors. Everybody, we told them no checkers, everybody's a supervisor. That's what we told the port doc. Can you imagine that? We got away with it, too.
They're probably so grateful just to get to work, they would give you
whatever. We had them on the upper hand, which we shouldn't have never did to them, but we did it anyway.
Mm-hmm. It was Lee's feeling that one of the reasons the 71 strike drug on for so long is because it wasn't a real shutdown. That if there had been a real serious shutdown, that it might have been settled sooner without Taft-Hartley and all that stuff.
I think they were shut down. Most of the places was operating. Seattle was operating a little bit, and Portland was operating a little. Every place had their own little secret deal. What they had in San Francisco, in a place I couldn't tell you. But everybody had a little secret deal going. But I think the whole idea was that once we went on strike, I'm sure Bridges thought, we're going to stay so long and give them, because he didn't want to go on strike. He tried every way he knew how to keep them off of a strike. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I was at that convention, I'm sure, at the big caucus. And he couldn't do it. He'd seen them young Bucks, as I'll call them. Boy, they were gung-ho. They wanted to, this or this. And so he decided, what the hell. Then they made us go back to work. We went back to work a month.
The Taft-Hartley.
Yeah, and then we went back on strike again for another 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I and a few of my cohorts hit us just right. It was in the summertime. We went to Longacres every day. I told my wife, I said, I forget how many we had at home then, but I told my wife, $100 a week, that's it now, no more. So she got $100 every week out of the bank, and that's what we made it on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a ball. And I'm sure she did too.
Had most people saved up for that one?
I think most of them had a little money, yeah. Some of them. But I don't know, I guess you could get food stamps and anything you wanted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't force myself to ever go. Get it, I'm not that type, But I guess you can get them, but everybody seemed to survive. I didn't hear too many hollering, because they would get, and then we'd work a day or so,
mm-hmm.
in that week, so that would pay the lights and water. I know, we didn't go, the only thing went behind at my house was my bank account, that went behind. That's the only thing.
Yeah.
But then, I guess in a strike, somebody got to pay, both sides, that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. What about when, I'm trying to remember when the thing with A and B men first came in. It was before the M&M in 61. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on splitting the registration between A and B men, whether you think that's generally been a good thing to have that classification of B-men, because I've heard from some things I've read and stuff, I've heard some criticisms of it a lot of the stuff I've read in terms of the criticisms, it was from the sort of B-man's point of view that he you know, I mean, he has no voice in the union. He doesn't have, I mean, the union controls his conditions, but he doesn't have anything to say about,
right.
about what happens. And
yeah.
sort of second-class
yeah.
citizen.
Yeah, he's a second-class citizen, all right. But he don't stop to realize he would be a fourth class if he was just a casual, see?
Mm-hmm.
And surely the union could operate just with casual if they wanted to, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you could break the casual just as well as you can break a B-man in, you know, to drive no inch, but we have rules that says you can't, see? But the casual drive all the equipment, see? All with the winches and the cranes and stuff like that. Some of the casual can drive straddles, which happens lots of times. They
mm-hmm.
drive straddle, they drive everything there is. But they can't be on deck. Can't drive the winches. Now you know they can drive the winches if somebody broke them in. Same thing as a B-man. A B-man, I don't know. And maybe I would have did the same thing if I would have got to be a B-man. I had to sit there 2 or 3 years. See, but one thing they don't realize is that they get all the benefits. They get health and welfare, they get vacation, they get accounts on their. And it counts on their pension, counts on everything. Everything counts.
Another thing that I've heard is that the employer, maybe this is not in this port, but experiences in other ports, uses the B-men in some sense to, and they drive the B-men harder to try and push the A-men. Or I mean, sort of they divide and conquer kind of stuff, that if they can feel they can create a division there.
I don't think it's the employer.
Uh-huh.
I think it's the longshoremen that drive the B-men.
Uh-huh.
I really do. I, you know, they take advantage of them. No question about that. You know, because they can't say nothing. Mm-hmm. Some longshoremen says, hey, you know, goodbye, I gotta go. What can the B-men say? And that's happened many a time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that probably it took me.
Is it true B-men tend to get the worst jobs?
Yeah, they get second pick.
So they
got to.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. There's nothing wrong with that, really. Because
mm-hmm.
You got guys there, not like me. I've been there, say I was there 30 years, and here comes a B-man right now. Now, he shouldn't get the same opportunity I got for that job. So we got no. Well, every union in the coast has a seniority system, not Tacoma. Never had a seniority system.
Mm-hmm.
Where an old guy ain't got any more shot than a young guy. That's an A-man. And we got lots of A-men up there, and I know lots of them that they wouldn't lift their hat, you know, to hard work. So, you know, they're not going to work. All they do is take all the cream.
Mm-hmm.
All the cream. So they finally created a dock list, that's for old timers and cripples, you know. So they can make it, they do pretty good there. You know, we got a few old guys in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blessing, but it's a terrible job. Myself, when I figured I couldn't cut her anymore, I went on the clerk's list.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up a supervisor. So that was a pretty good job, thank you. Excellent job. But if you had to stay 8 hours or whatever you're supposed to, sure was an excellent job.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, maybe I know a few people, maybe that's why I got Pier 7 over. I made a lot of people mad, I know that, but it didn't bother me too much. I figured I did enough for them, so
mm-hmm.
it owed me a favor, too.
In your contact with, when did you retire?
I think, let's see, this is 81. I think I've been retired. I think this is 78, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. So you were here for the changeover to containerization? And
oh, yes, you know
all
that.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
Do you see much difference between the attitudes towards the union and towards work of the younger men who are on the docks now and like the guys you started with?
Yeah, quite a bit. I don't think the attitudes are there anymore. You know, it used to be in you go to a place that wasn't union. Hey, your name was Bud. That's what they taught you. That's what your dad taught you. I don't think the dads, and myself included, don't teach them that now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I try to teach my children not to go. McDonald's, I don't think, well, maybe they have now, but I know when they were youngsters, they had never been in a McDonald's.
No, McDonald's doesn't have a union yet.
Yeah.
I've had young friends, teenage friends who have worked there. One woman who tried to organize a union at one McDonald's in Los Angeles, and when they got the little sign-up cards and all that stuff, they found out that the bargaining unit, the NLRB had ruled in another case that the bargaining unit was all the McDonald's within a certain and that way she just sort of threw up her hands and said, I can't do that. I mean, there are, you know, 100 McDonald's within 50 miles. I'm not going to be able to organize all those people.
They tried this in here in town, you know, up here in Tacoma Avenue. They tried that one, and they had it all set to go, and he took the guy that runs the place calls them all in, and they give them a little better deal, and they lost the election.
Yeah. Now, McDonald's is real smart. They have a policy of keeping the union out. They do whatever they have to.
They're just like Coors beer. See? You can try all you want. You're never going to get Coors. He's made up his mind. That's it. Made up his mind.
He's willing to take whatever losses are necessary.
He's made up his mind. But this, you can notice in all, Pierce County was a tough labor town, you know, especially Tacoma. But it's, you go around here, you have the restaurants. There's lots of restaurants, non-union. And they're all going this way. Why? I can't tell you. But then people herself are not union-minded, like even me, you know, tough union guy I was. I go in places now, it's not in union. I shouldn't do this, but I do. Maybe for the price, or I don't know what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
I think nowadays that the youngsters better watch their P's and Q's, because they're bringing in all these foreigners, and you know them, they're going to work pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
They got to work. That's what they're here for.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't, I think union's in tough shape. All union, myself, if they don't march.
Mm-hmm.
They don't march. And it would really be a sad blow for this country.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Sad blow, because the unions are the, to me, it's the backbone of everything. Without the union, why, I don't think this country, well, they say it could operate. I don't believe that. Because
mm-hmm.
who pays all the bills? All you got to do is figure it out, who pays the bill?
Mm-hmm.
The working men, and if without the union, they ain't going to get that kind of wages to pay all them bills.
Mm-hmm.
No way. As far as our union here, I couldn't tell you. I am not too familiar. In fact, the new B list, the one that they're taking in now, I know very few of them. I know maybe 10 of them that I've seen.
Because their sons are...
Well, if they were sons, I would know most of them, but lots of them are not sons. Now the new bunch again, I wouldn't probably know any of them. I just got away from it. That's the way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's right. When you retire, the whole idea is to stop thinking about work.
Well, I kind of did that before I retired, too. I think it was the last, Fort Williams and I did it together. About the last maybe 3 or 4 years that I worked there, I didn't run for nothing. I wouldn't run for the executive board, or one time they wanted me to be on the Puget Sound Council. I said, no thanks, you get somebody else. There's lots of them around there. They can, you know, after all them years and you do all this, it all takes time, and especially the president job. Boy, that is a toughie, let me tell you. If you got a good business, I know it's, George is a good business agent. He's excellent, and you know, he tends to business, so it's easy on the president, you know. But if you haven't, one time I was president, and he went to, he was down in California on negotiation. Yeah, he was down there, oh Christ, just constantly. And this one time been gone a month, and had a young guy who was, oh my God. Now I'm working nights. I've always been a night worker. I was out of bed 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, trying to do his job and mine too, and you can't do things like that, you know. It was just an awful mess. So I'd take him aside and I'd tell him, you know, and I did it real nice, you know. I didn't want to embarrass him or anything like that. I explain to him what he had to do and then make sure he did it. Oh, yeah. And then I'd ask him, did you? Yeah, yeah. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do none of the things I told him to do. Finally, I told him, by God, now, if you don't shape up here, I'm going to tell the membership. And he kind of shaped up a little bit then. Mm-hmm. And helped out a little, but it's just tough. Really, it's a thankless job. Really thankless.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, because if they don't get any sack, longshoremen are funny people. You see them every day, you know. They come every day. They're not like another labor union. You go up the window and you pay your dues, and maybe you say hi. You don't know even say know who you're saying hi to, but you say hi anyway, and you go about your business. But then longshoremen come every day, and they're right there, you know. They're taking chunks out of your, you know what? Boy, they yackers, them guys. Tough to deal with, but you gotta have a strong constitution. George got it, I guess. He must have an iron constitution.
Well, he's certainly been doing it for a long time.
Christ, he could stay that long. I don't know. But he's a good one. He don't. No monkey business. He gets on them too, you know, the longshore, and you have to. You have to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't have any more specific questions unless there was anything you particularly wanted to say.
When I come here, I didn't intend to say as much as I did.
Well, see, that's my job, is to get you to talk.
Now you gotta.
Because everybody tells me, oh, I don't have anything to say.
Now you gotta decipher it, see?
Yeah.